We're really happy today to have Grant Urban from the city of Pittsburgh, gets to be a graduate, so an alumnus of our school, and talking about smart cities and sustainability. As many of you know, there was a national competition for smart cities, and Pittsburgh made the final group of cities that were considered. And developing the smart cities is a hot topic in urban development and municipal management. But what exactly is it? So Grant's here to fill us in on all those kinds of things. He is in the Chief Resilient Officer of the City of Pittsburgh, and we're going to talk about the proposal, lessons learned, some other thoughts that he has, and then open it up for questions and Q&A. So, Grant?
Super.
Good. Welcome.
All right. Thank you, Sabina. I got to adjust all these technology now. Let's see, I'm going to unmute. And can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Good. All right. So, thanks everyone for indulging me here today. I'm really excited to be able to speak with you all about some of the great work that we're doing here at the City of Pittsburgh. And really excited, actually, just to be back to my alma mater here at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. When you guys invited me back, that made me think of a couple things. One is that I paid my final tuition bill, so that was good. Check. And then I got real nervous when I walked up the escalator, because then I wanted to make sure that I had my final paper in, which was also submitted. So check two. So I don't think I have any outstanding debts or grievances, so I think I'm all accounted for. And the other reason I think I'm really excited about being here is I've been having a lot of fun working at the City of Pittsburgh and doing the things that we're doing, and a lot of that I owe to mentors and teachers like Sabina and the folks here at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs and partners at UXER. Bob and Mike, who are in the back, are guys that I've worked with for a long time, and really excited to have partnership with them and helping us do a lot of the great things that we're doing here today. So what I wanted to do, just to give you a kind of the quick arc of the presentation, in case you have to leave early, I want to give you the bluff or the bottom line up front. So I want to share with you a video that we developed that will do a really great job in terms of setting some of the context with regards to our smart cities proposal. But then I want to dive into some really deeper conversations and share with you some of the lessons that I personally have learned in this smart cities experience. But also I want to talk with you about some of the large arcs and trends that are occurring in cities, and talk not just about smart cities, but also talk about sustainable cities and resilient cities. And at the end, I want to talk and have a conversation about how we can start to fuse some of these conversations together. So with that, I have displayed unmute, and I believe I just need to hit play. And
chances are you've heard some things about us. We're the ones who shoveled iron ore into the blast furnaces and ran our streetlights during the day. We did the unglamorous work that helped build a nation, and we've got the scars to prove it. Sure, we've got a reputation. The way we see it, we've got a reputation to uphold. Yeah, steel will always be a part of our identity, but really, it's innovation that's in our DNA. From steamboats to glass to steel to aluminum, Pittsburgh was always at the forefront of innovation. We created the modern highway system. We powered the first nuclear submarine. When the steel industry famously turned our city into hell with the lid off, we set about to clean up, instituting the first clean air regulations of their kind. We know a thing or two about looking challenges in the eye and seeing opportunities. Hills, rivers, and valleys forced our 55 square miles into an unruly tangle of roads and bridges. Out of that grew 90 distinct neighborhoods. Some have prospered with the city's ups and downs. Others haven't had a seat at the table. In the past, progress for some meant decline for others. As city residents fled to the suburbs, we cut highways through the hearts of vibrant communities, leaving large swaths of our diverse population isolated. Maybe there were times we forgot what we stood for, but we always come back stronger. We're still creating industries, but this time around we're using 21st century technology and engineering to get us there. Universities, nonprofits, and businesses are working together to build robots, cure diseases, and design better products. And we're just getting started. With Smart PGH, we're at the cusp of the next revolution in transportation and information technology that has the potential to have huge impacts on the way we live. We're deploying the most advanced traffic signals in the world to move people, bikes, and vehicles both faster and safer. These signals actually learn, and they're made right here at home. We're rolling out smart streetlights with sensors that communicate with traffic and even monitor air quality. We're building new infrastructure for autonomous and electric vehicles and charging them without fossil fuels. And this time, we're putting people first, training our residents for jobs of the future, and working on the ground in every neighborhood to make certain these technologies are actually making people's lives better. Smart PGH isn't simply our next project. It's our next chance. A chance to chart a course, to bridge the gaps between ourselves. A chance to be the blueprint for other cities like us. We're thinkers and doers. It's what's allowed us to bounce back, to shake off the rust, and keep moving. Our hardworking ethic, our spirit of innovation, those aren't going anywhere. But this time around, we've made the decision. If it's not for all, it's not for us.
So, wanted to start out with that because it fundamentally, for us as a team within the city, brought together the message that we were looking to share with the nation about Pittsburgh and about the vision that we were looking to develop with regards to what it means to be a smart city. And the first thing I'd like to say about this is that this was a very challenging process. And effectively what that process was, it started out with a challenge that was initiated by the United States Department of Transportation around $40 million. A $40 million winner-take-all grant that the USDOT would put forth. And that grew to $50 million with an additional $10 million investment to be made by Vulcan Philanthropies, which was the foundation of Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft. And cities around the country gravitated to this opportunity. There was over 77 finalists from around the country that fit the parameters of the grant, cities that put forth applications and built teams. And it was a great challenge in the fact that it allowed cities, I want to say for the first time, but one of the first times in kind of the last 5-10 years to really think strategically about what it means to be a smart city. And in the city of Pittsburgh, we put together an awesome team, number one. I was a part of that team with colleagues in both the city, but also with universities and private sector partners. I think we ended up having well over 50 letters of support from collaborators in the private sector, university sector, nonprofits, that were a part of what I'll call Team Pittsburgh. And then there was kind of the core group of us within city operations that were really allowed to imagine what this means. And one of the things that happened was that we confronted all the bells and whistles that are available to a city in terms of the influx of technology that is now in front of us that fundamentally is changing how we operate as local governments. And it's easy to get enamored with that technology. It's easy to look at the shiny tool that's out there that's available, the bells and whistles. Those things are sexy. And about halfway through the process, we stopped ourselves. And we said, it's not about the technology. It's about people. And we had to fundamentally kind of reshift our thinking and understanding all the stuff that we're working on beyond kind of infrastructure and technology and data and really get back to the core of why it is we do what we do, particularly as a local government. You know, you learn here in Gispia about kind of the ideas around local government and what that means. In the state of Pennsylvania, there's some fundamental things that we understand about what it means to be a local government. To provide for the health, the safety, and the welfare of the citizens. And that is one thing that is absolutely core to this concept that we can't forget. Health, safety, and welfare of our citizens. It's not about big data. It's not about the amount of lines and wires and autonomous vehicles. That stuff's all great and that's happening, but we have to understand why. And that's where we came up with that tagline at the end, if it's not for all, it's not for us. It brought us back to kind of being a grounded factor within our team of understanding what we're fundamentally working for. And in fact, effectively, what is a smart city? And for us, it was really about how do you put people first in the decision-making process. And that means incorporating the needs of all people in the decision-making process. It was a fundamental shift for us. And I would go on record as saying, in terms of the Department of Transportation, the challenge, we flipped what they thought the conversation was about as well. It's not just about these technology movements that are afoot, but it's how does a city start to provide a foundation to enable the connection between both technology, decision-making, architecture, and the people that were there to serve. So what I want to do today, with your indulgence, is to help set a context for what's inside of our proposal, and then at the end talk a little bit about some of the details about the proposal, where we see some of these things going forward. I don't want to get into a presentation right now about kind of the minutiae of what we're asking for, but I want you to think about some of the bigger things that are afoot within cities and how they apply into this greater conversation. So first, I want to talk about the confluence of some, what I'll call, and I'm searching for some better words here, but some tectonic trends that are impacting cities and why we're having this conversation here today. The first is that there's three big movements that are afoot. We see them all in the news, but let me bring them together for you for the sake of this conversation. There's issues of globalization, of climate change, and of urbanization. Let me just pick on one and give you some facts and figures on urbanization. Rough figures. In 1950, in America, 70% of our population lived in rural communities. 30% lived in urban communities. By 2050, 100 years later, that's going to fundamentally shift. You're going to have around 67 to 70% of people living in urbanized areas and 30% living in rural areas. A second kind of thing that's afoot that brings this conversation to bear is the convergence of systems. About a year and a half ago, the Green Building Alliance, through their Inspire Speaker Series, had a fellow by the name of Jeremy Rifkin. Anybody heard of Jeremy Rifkin here? A couple folks. And he gave a talk at their Inspire Speaker Series, and he introduced this concept, which I think is very fundamental to where cities are at today, and it's the convergence of systems, specifically energy and utilities, transportation and mobility systems, and ICT networks, or information communication technology. And Rifkin says that any time in the course of history where these three areas have converged, you've had an explosion of ideas and economic and social development. And we're there again. Where energy and utilities, transportation and mobility systems, and ICT networks are able to talk to one another. They're able to coexist in ways that create new products, new services, and new opportunities. And that leads me to kind of my third point, which is effectively that as a result of these tectonic trends, globalization, climate change, urbanization, and then these systems confluences, that we're having conversations about cities, specifically smart cities, sustainable cities, and resilient cities. And what does it mean to be those three things? And I'm going to dive into that in a little bit. But first let me answer a question about, so why cities? And I would open this up to, it's not just cities, that's a context in which I operate in, but I would say that it's broader in terms of local governments are really this fundamental unit of opportunity, in that local government provides a platform that can foster the collaboration, that one has to deal with these mega trends, but it also it's the right unit with regards to the confluence of these systems. So local governments, in terms of cities, towns, boroughs, whatever kind of the unit that you want to focus on, really become units that are critical because they sit at this epicenter. They're dealing with these issues each and every day. And one of the reasons why is that they create an effective form of engagement. We deal directly with our citizens each and every day. They are our clients, our consumers. We are their fundamental point of contact, whether it's your, you know, picking up your recycling or your pothole in the road in front of you, or there's a cat stuck up a tree, or the house next door is on fire. You don't call the state or federal government, you call your local government. So we're really creating kind of consumable information at the local level that really enhances the decision-making that people need in their day-to-day lives. The other thing that is kind of interesting, and there's some great projects here that the University of Pittsburgh is responsible for through items like the Institute of Politics or Next Door at Connect, where local governments are fundamentally working together, finding ways in which they can collaborate to jointly solve some of these complex problems that at a larger scale are unsolvable. But when you bring those units together, they can start to think more creatively as well as more innovatively about how to solve them. The other thing to think about at the local level, and I know this, I'm going to say this maybe a couple times a day, this is a challenging day to maybe have this conversation given what's going on in Washington, but if you take an issue like climate change, and I don't know where anybody sits with regards to climate change, but at the local level there can't be a debate because it doesn't matter if it's snow or rain or heat or a flood, you have to clean up the streets. You have to mitigate the risk that is caused by an event. So it's a day-to-day operations, and if you could think more intuitively about how do you mitigate that risk, that's something that local government professionals do every day. Similarly, you see at the local level, cities having to deal with these other megatrends, things like migration, for example, and how do you move the course of massive amounts of people because of a cataclysmic event in one part of the world is all of a sudden impacting your world. Local government leaders in cities in Europe, for example, are confronting this each and every day of how do you house tens of thousands of people that weren't on your doorstep maybe a year or more ago. So local government really becomes a critical unit of analysis and of opportunity with regards to how do we solve some of these major challenges. Now, for me, one of the things that's probably been most interesting in this equation and kind of how I came into the smart cities conversation was my role as what's called the Chief Resilience Officer. Has anybody ever heard of a Chief Resilience Officer before? Dave, you don't count because I work with you. And Alex, I work with you too. So most folks haven't heard of what is a Chief Resilience Officer. So it's important to kind of weave this into the story. So a Chief Resilience Officer is a position that was created by the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities Initiative. So taking a couple steps back, during Mayor Peduto's transition, he had organized a 1,000-person civic transition team. And one of the things that I was fortunate enough to do is to help manage the sustainability and entrepreneurship team. And one of the recommendations that citizens put forth to us was to be engaged in the global conversation around cities. And as a relatively, what I would call a young administration or a new administration, we were at a point in time where we needed the opportunity to develop a strategy. And the 100 Resilient Cities Network is a network of cities that is fundamentally looking at the practice of urban systems management a little bit differently. It's not really foreign to local government professionals, but really starting to think about how the issues of risk and risk mitigation play out at the local level. And we developed an application as the city of Pittsburgh to be a part of this network. And one of the strings that are attached to that is that we had to assign a chief resilience officer to that role. And because it was my fault to get involved with the grant, they said, go ahead and figure this out. So you become this guy with this funny title. Now, what the role is, and we're all kind of defining this as we go, but in our mind, what it's really been about is fundamentally doing a couple things. First is to develop strategies. And within those strategies is to identify what are first our shocks and stresses. Shocks being events or immediate negative impacts that could be really detrimental to the course and arc and history of a city. Think of an earthquake, a typhoon, or a hurricane. But there's also this issue of stresses. These are long-standing, slow-moving problems like generational poverty or poor air quality or poor water quality. And it's within this context that we are developing a strategy that is geared to, one, in our mind, create better coordination structures, which I'll touch upon in a moment, but also how do you create systems that are agile, responsive, and also mitigate risk? So what it's been over the course of the past year plus is that we've developed our what's called a preliminary resilience assessment, which is kind of diving into what are the shocks and the stresses of the city. And then now we're at the final stages of developing the city's resilience strategy. And critical amongst that has been this process of community engagement. And not just community engagement and talking and asking people what they think, but community empowerment. Asking people not just what they think, but what can they do about it? How can we, as a city government, or partners with other civic institutions, work with residents to empower them to address at the local level some of these major challenges? The other key piece of my puzzle has been developing the city's climate action plan. Like the resilience strategy, we're in the final phases of kind of the research and development, looking towards the prioritization of these strategies. And this has all been the result of numerous town halls, focus groups, and what we found is a couple of key things. And just to keep you reminding, this all flows back into why, if it's not for all, it's not for us. So through this community outreach, we've discovered a couple things, and it's not like big aha moments. These are things that we all know as Pittsburghers, or things that are part of the civic conversation, but it's more about declaring them. And that is the issues of economic and racial disparity, infrastructure decline, and climate risk are really our top stressors. And I like to talk about that Pittsburgh is a stressful city, not like we're all nervous and jittery and stuff, like Seattle because they drink too much caffeine. But we have a lot of underlying stresses that are the biggest problems that we face. We're not going to be faced with sea level rise, God willing, like Norfolk, or a hurricane like New Orleans, or an earthquake like San Francisco. But our fundamental challenge is how do we deal with these major stresses? And one of the things that I have found in this, and these are the things that we're hearing from the community, is the ability to start to connect some dots. And I want to explore this a little bit with you, both in terms of my remarks, but also the question and answer session. Locally, though, we have not found the ability to connect these challenges to deeper issues that are at play. I think this is fundamental to today's conversation also. And that is that as a society, or as Pittsburghers, we're not making a recognition about issues of isolation, in terms of social, economic, geographic, or gender isolation. We're all in our tribes, if you will. And ignorance. And that's the issues of the lack of awareness, the lack of empathy, or understanding. And the third thing that we're not doing is that we're not bridging these connections of disparity and climate change and infrastructure to the individual issues of public health. Fundamentally, how does being impoverished or having an aging and decaying infrastructure impacting our health and well-being. So with those things in mind, what I wanted to do is provide a deeper understanding in terms of kind of the context of what it means to be a smart or sustainable or resilient city. And this is where the confluence of what you saw in the video and what the essence in part of what our application to the USDOT was really about. So first, what is a smart city? Everybody's going to have their own definition. You'll talk to 50 people and they'll give you 50 different definitions. Today I'm up here, so I'm going to give you mine. So a smart city is fundamentally really about resource and asset management. That can be in terms of transportation systems, utilities, environmental assets, financial capital, or citizen engagement. And a smart city is really about how do you improve the allocation of those resources and services to fundamentally improve what city or urban or local government, what life in your town is all about. A couple lessons from the smart city that I picked up over the past couple years here. One, like in the video, it's important to start with people in mind, not technology. It's not about whiz-bang gizmos, sensors, but you got to fundamentally first think about people. Second piece is that you have to think big. And you have to be able to identify the right scale in which to make the intervention. And the other thing is you have to think in terms of networks and systems. Going back to that confluence of systems is that this conversation is really integrated. And you just can't think about energy without thinking about water, without thinking about mobility, without thinking about people. Let me give you a quick example. So a couple years ago, one of the things that we started was an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, partnership between the city and our university partners, both at Carnegie Mellon and here at the University of Pittsburgh. And we have a rich dossier of projects in which we're involved with researchers and faculty and students in basically investigating a whole host of activities at the local government level. And one of the concepts that we worked on was the idea of an energy intelligence network. And I call it Project Azizan. So there's a colleague of ours, Azizan Aziz, who's at the School of Architecture at Carnegie Mellon, and he came to me with this idea of managing energy within the buildings of the city of Pittsburgh. All for it. I think it's great. Let's do it. And what we started to look at was this idea that we can connect 5 buildings and we can display on a screen like this all the energy consumption, and this is going to be real easy. Yeah, it's really easy. Not easy at all. In fact, one of the fundamental issues was is that we didn't do the things that I just told you about. We didn't look at the network connections. Some of the buildings that we wanted to hook up didn't have internet connectivity. Some of the building automation systems didn't have software activation. So there's just a whole host of problems that we didn't know about. So our 5 buildings is now down to a single floor in the city-county building where we're deploying 100 sensors, and I can tell you all the energy that we're consuming. But the ability to scale that up was our fundamental challenge because we didn't have the core infrastructure in place. So what's a sustainable city? Again, and I'm going to go through this in each example, but everybody's going to give you a definition, so today it's mine. So a sustainable city, I like to think about it really in terms of the root of the word. Sustainability is really about the ability to endure. To use an athletic analogy, you kind of break it up really in terms of a marathon runner. Can you finish the 26.2 miles? As a city, it's very much in a similar type of context. Can you define and cultivate and curate systems that it can endure and last over time? And this is both in terms of where social equity comes in, the environment, and a local economy. For Pittsburgh, what we've done is we've really thought about this in the context of two operations activities. One is our internal, and the second is our external. Internal, really thinking in terms of kind of our physical assets as something that's no different than a mid-sized corporation with 3,000 employees. We have 300 facilities and 1,000 fleet vehicles. How do we manage those assets to last and endure? And thinking about those 3 tenets of sustainability, of equity, environment, and economy. Externally, it's really thinking about how do we make the city a sustainable and enduring place, right? So thinking about those external systems like transportation energy networks, water, air quality, and how do we guide policy and capital investments to influence those so the city lasts and endures over time. A couple lessons on a sustainable city. Number one is that you have to work internally and you cannot ignore the external. You have to do both. A lot of cities look at this in an isolation activity in terms of just thinking about what they do with their operations, but then you're leaving all of your external factors exposed to risk. Second point is that you really have to think in terms of collaborations and how to solve problems, right? Our university partnerships, our partnerships with community-based NGOs and the private sector have been fundamental for us as a local government to really think about our operations and how do we start to fuse the best of all these worlds together. But also, what we've been able to do, I think, is to encourage leadership for those other sectors to think along with us. So, good example in this space is really thinking about our Eco-Innovation District. So the Eco-Innovation District project started out with a concept of connecting via a transportation line downtown in Oakland, something that's been talked about for generations. Sabina throws her hands up. This has been, everybody, we talk about this if you're from Pittsburgh. And one of the things that we thought about was, it's not about transportation. Transportation's but one part of the conversation of that corridor between downtown and Oakland. In the midst of that, you have a really great neighborhood called Uptown. Actually, there's a couple different names for it. Uptown, Soho, The Bluff. But what we thought about was it's more than transportation. It's also about land use and energy and waste and urban design. And the purpose of the Eco-Innovation District project was to really think about how those things fuse together and can operate in a way that leverages the best of all those activities to create a really great place. And the conversation, which 10, 15 years ago was about how do you get through Uptown, is really now a conversation about how do you go to Uptown. And how does Uptown connect with the broader network in terms of transportation and neighborhood connectivity. So really thinking fundamentally for us internally about operations, but also externally about the factors that we can bring to bear to help create great neighborhood development, to leverage connectivity between places, and really encourage economic development and investment. So what's a resilient city? So resilience, like sustainability, I'm going to use an athletic analogy for you. Resilience is really about the ability to adapt and strengthen systems during times of both calm and crisis. It's the athlete that is kind of the, what's a good catch? I was going to use a bad joke, but I won't. It's really thinking about the decathlon. So how do you exercise strength and speed and agility in order to deal with whatever comes your way? And to think about that in a city context. It's about the mitigation of risk. How do we strengthen systems and create what we call the resilience dividend? The resilience dividend is this idea of taking on a multi-attributional way to solve problems. You're not isolating an activity. You're not just building a bridge from A to B, but you're thinking within that construction of the bridge, how do you mitigate stormwater? How do you encourage economic activity? How do you reduce economic disparities? How do you leverage green infrastructure and green design into the construction of that building? So it's a different way of thinking. Instead of a very linear process, it's thinking a more holistic way in which we approach the business that we have each and every day. Which leads me to some of the lessons that we've discovered in resilience. So one of the fundamental challenges, and those of you who studied local government, and I'm sure you probably talk about this in your class, is the issue of fragmentation. In Pennsylvania, we have 2,600 plus units of local government. In southwestern Pennsylvania, we have 130 municipalities in Allegheny County alone. But the problem is not just local government. This fragmentation extends to the philanthropic sector, to non-governmental organizations, to the private sector, all people that are trying to do good things in their own way. The resilience conversation has allowed us to think differently about that. It's about how do we mitigate the challenges caused by fragmentation by creating better coordination. How do we start to leverage the good that we're all doing towards a higher purpose, to use resources more efficiently and more effectively? Let me give you a couple examples there. One is the Green Infrastructure Master Plan that the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority has developed. PWSA, and everybody, show of hands, Consent Decree, Clean Water Act violation, people are familiar with it? All right, pretty good, pretty knowledgeable group. So one of the challenges that we face here is clean water. It's one of those stresses that I talked about. And that's both in terms of aging infrastructure, but also the water quality within our rivers. It's caused by combined sewer overflows, which is really caused because of fragmentation, because of land use decisions, and a host of other activities. And what we've asked within the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority is to develop a plan that's not just about water, but also about three other things. How do we mitigate risk and look at hazards? How do we look at community economic development? And how do we look at economic development opportunities? And what that does is, instead of looking at across the broad 55 square miles of the city of Pittsburgh, it allows us to target those opportunities and resources to places where we can reduce flow, create community and economic impact, and also mitigate risk. So kind of that multi-attributional benefit of the resilience dividend that I talked about. A second example, which really started to come to bear, and this is a somewhat of a nascent idea within the Smart Cities proposal, was the issue around what we call the Smart PGH Consortium. And this was a key component of the development of the Smart City strategy. For the first time in recent memory, we brought together all of the major infrastructure investors in the city of Pittsburgh. Allegheny County, the Port Authority, Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission, all of the major utilities, basically anybody who is going to rip up a road or has a capital infrastructure decision. And going back to those confluence of ideas, right? The network connections, the energy, the utilities, transportation and mobility, and communications technologies. How do we start to overcome that fragmentation issue, but for by bringing them together to start to align capital, policy, and data decisions? A fundamental kind of rethink in terms of how we operate. So I want to go back to this point of isolation and ignorance and kind of bring this to a point. So that's not my idea. I didn't come up with it. I'm not that smart. A couple months ago, prior to the election, I was a part of a team that went to the Congress of Urban and Metropolitan Universities Conference, KUMU. Do you know KUMU? So we went with a team from Duquesne, and everybody sat at a luncheon and was eating their meal, and they sat the plenary, a couple panel folks, and a fellow introduced himself, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but he sat there and he said, I'm a senior fellow, which means I can say whatever the hell I want. And everybody everybody put their forks down, and they turned to the stage and looked at him, and he said, the biggest threat to America is not ISIS, but ignorance. And this collective ignorance is being fueled by isolation. And that quote has stuck with me for the better part of 4 months now. And just to give you a quick story, how this kind of connects back to smart cities, is that over the summer I had the chance to go to Conneaut Lake, Pennsylvania. Anybody familiar with Conneaut Lake? Anybody from Conneaut Lake? All right, even better. So Conneaut Lake is in northwestern Pennsylvania, and there is an amusement park there called Conneaut Lake Park. And as a kid, my family and I would vacation up there, and I spent endless summers at Conneaut Lake Park, and it was just the most amazing place. And so when it was time to pick a family vacation, I said, we're going to Conneaut Lake. My wife and two daughters were like, where the hell is that? Why do we want to go there? So I convinced them, and we went. We had a great time. But the park was in utter disarray. And there was nobody there. The first night, there might have been 50 people in the entire amusement park. Anybody familiar with the movie Vacation? So like Wally World, right? It was like Wally World. Literally, we walked through the gate, and there was nobody there. I was waiting for like John Candy and Chevy Chase to show up. And not only was the park drastically different, but the thing that for me was interesting was the experience of the people that I met there. In my memory of Conneaut Lake Park, going back a couple decades now, is really about everyone. And it was a confluence of society, of guys that worked in the mill, of men and women in the manufacturing business, different manufacturing concerns. And when we were there, there was clearly this issue of people that were experiencing loss and financial hardship. And when we took a tour around the lake, a lot of the things that we found, my dad was a manufacturer's rep, so he worked with a lot of folks in the tool and die industry, which was very prevalent in northwestern Pennsylvania at the time, and those businesses and those warehouses were empty. And the thing that I recognize is that this experience for me in my city bubble isn't an isolated experience. It's not just happening in Conneaut Lake, Pennsylvania. It's happening in places in our own backyard. It's happening in neighborhoods less than a mile from here. And the fundamental disconnection between the places here and the places there is one of the things that we're all forgetting about. And it's because of this issue of isolation that we're all in our bubbles and our inability to connect with one another. And one of the things that we're starting to see, though, and this has been really brought to bear in our conversations with folks in the resilience strategy, is that there's a lack of social cohesion or this sense of common purpose and common connectivity. And this feeling is both physical in terms of where folks are living, there's the place-based identity, and it's mental in terms of our agency in society. And it's rural, it's urban, and it's suburban. And this lack of personal security, to loop back to what I said in the very beginning, is part of these megatrends, right? Globalization, climate change, and urbanization. The mobility of people and jobs, how that influences our local communities, the challenges that we face from an environmental standpoint, and the growing flow of people to urban centers away from kind of the traditional path or living positions that we've had. And the other challenge that we see here is the pace of things, right? That the pace of these trends is creating these unsettling reverberations throughout the community fabric. As being a part of this global network, the thing that has been most heartening to me is two things. One is the collegiality of cities, but also the common language of cities. And it's because of that common language of cities that we're able to share that what I'm telling you about our experience here in Pittsburgh is happening in small towns like Vejle, Denmark, who's a partner of ours, in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, in Rio de Janeiro, in Seattle. It's all a common conversation. And the thing that we have to keep in mind, and to bring this back again, is that subsequently these strains are placing great strains on our institutions. So what we feel in our daily lives because of these movements and trends is impacting things like local government, like social services, and ultimately our local economies. And it's these strains on these systems that are putting great stresses that we have to figure out, you're going to have to help figure out, is how do we start to bring these confluences together. And that's why I think it's important that we have this convergence between smart, sustainable, and resilient. So given that, I want to lay out a couple things that maybe we can discuss together. Four key points. One is that the ability to create community and community connections to opportunities, really fusing together and creating this social cohesion, is absolutely imperative. You know, there's a great sociological study about the Chicago heat wave. Is anybody familiar with the Chicago heat wave analysis? You know, it looks at, two neighborhoods in Chicago, and there's just a totally bastardize it in a brief synopsis here, is it gets really hot in Chicago, bunch of people die, but different neighborhoods react in different ways. And a lot of that reaction is based upon the social connectivity between neighbors. One way that we're working on this in the city of Pittsburgh is a program that we call Love Your Block. We've kind of co-opted the name, we now call it Love Your Resilient Block. But the idea is fundamentally, how can you make a small investment at the block level to, one, bring neighbors together to solve a common problem or facilitate the benefit of a common opportunity? Which leads to kind of my other theme here, which I've talked a little bit about earlier, but that is, we have to put people first. So whether it's a conversation about resilience or sustainability or smart cities or fundamentally how do we fuse them together, we have to really think about, in any strategy, how is it going to impact our daily lives as people? What's the human connection? Just to go back to the PWSA example for a second, what was really interesting about PWSA and how we started that conversation about green infrastructure was with basement backups. One of the things that PWSA found within the basement backups issue is we knew that there were a problem, but they were drastically undercounted. Not because of anything that the authority was doing, because Pittsburghers were being Pittsburghers. And that is to say that, oh, you get water in your basement. Yeah, it's just something that happens here. Well, there was hundreds of people that weren't reporting it because we just deal with it. We just endure. So understanding that human connection has allowed us to start to think differently about where infrastructure is placed. That leads me to a third point, which is about how do we solve big problems. And when we're connecting these confluence conversations together, it's really important that we do it collaboratively and we do it at the local level. Again, so the idea of why cities is it, or why local governments is it, because we have the ability to respond in an agile way. And there's three things that we can look at just in these issues alone. One is emissions reduction, fundamentally how at the local level we can address climate change. How do we dig into tools like smart cities and mobility to connect people? And then finally, how do we start to educate people? How do we build this workforce, which is one of the fundamental challenges that we came across into smart cities? It's great to develop these technologies. It's great to make these investments. But the higher level thinking is, how do you start to create the economies and the technical skills and the workforce of tomorrow, and how do we do it here? And that's my final point. In order to create success in each of these activities, to address these challenges, we have to think of new forms of collaboration and ways in which to share data and information. You know, I talked a little bit about the Smart PGH Consortium. Many of you are probably familiar with the great work here at UXR and the Western Pennsylvania Regional Data Center. And also, if you're familiar with the work being done at Connect. One of the things that Connect has done, I think, is really, for most people, was probably incredibly boring, but it's incredibly important, which is about connecting utilities. You know, when you talk about issues of water and the cost of fixing our aging water infrastructure, the cost associated with building new green infrastructure to manage stormwater better, or if you talk about an aging gas and electrical grid, it's the same people that are paying for that, us. We're the customers, we're the clients. So how do we start to coordinate that capital in a way? How do we share that data and create the structures to really deliver fundamental change? So just a couple of ideas for you. I hope it was thoughtful, and really wanted to share with you some of the lessons that I've learned I'll be happy to talk about kind of all the nitty-gritty details, but I thought it's important that you get an understanding in terms of where these conversations are coming from. And as students and educators and practitioners, how do we work together to start to fuse these conversations in the research or in the applications that we're developing? Because fundamentally, we're charged with a big, big job, and that's solving these problems. So, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's open it up for questions and comments, starting back there.
A question about other types of cities. I think one of the this may not be one that you can answer, maybe some of the other people in the room have some thoughts about it, but we kind of have cities that are in the range of 150 to 200,000 people, of which we have a number in Pennsylvania, don't seem to have the critical mass to do this sort of thing. They don't have the large university. They don't have the critical mass for public transportation. They don't have in-migration. And these cities are, you know, places like Johnstown or Altoona, they really are, some do better than others, but it's really a challenge. And part of the reason that we saw what happened this morning, just happened at noon, is because these cities aren't going anywhere. And people don't see a lot of solutions. So do you have any ideas about how this sort of thing can be scaled for these smaller cities and what they can look at? Because they're all, you know, all across the country, they're just dying on the vine, it seems.
Yep, yeah, it's a good point. And I think it's both a challenge and an opportunity. So let me, you've categorized the challenge as well. Let me talk about some of the opportunities. I think that they are a perfect scale. And which is why Pittsburgh is so good in this conversation. One, we are blessed with a lot of riches in terms of the research universities, in terms of a very dynamic workforce, in terms of kind of a stable and well-intentioned political leadership. Those are all good things that we build on. The thing that is really great about Pittsburgh, and then I think what is the opportunity in the smaller cities, 100 to 200,000 person cities you talk about, is the agility. And in order to move something in London or New York, you're going to have a more glacial response. But if you have a good idea and a willing partnership, you can fundamentally make really quick and strategic changes. So let me give you an example, a Pennsylvania example. Like the city of York is one that has a well-intended business community, a mayor that is, you know, kind of engaged and looking to make progress, and you have tools as a local government. That's why I said this is not just a city conversation, but one that can be had in a borough or a township if well-intended as well, is that you can bring those partnerships to bear. Let me give you a quick example on how something like that can happen in a smart city space. Streetlights. Streetlights, and one of the things that we kind of lay out in our smart city strategy is streetlights are one of the fundamental technologies that is going to transform how we live. And you're like, most people are like, what? So every city and town, just about every city and town, has streetlights. And streetlights now are no longer just about lights. You go throughout like the course of history, why do we put up streetlights? Anybody know? Take a guess. Safety. Public safety, right? You know, because basically people were either getting pickpocketed or tripping and falling or, you know, went the wrong direction, but it was fundamentally about safety. So when you start to build on that basic concept of safety and illumination, you start to think about different things as these technologies, again, the ICT, the energy, and the mobility network start to confluence. So all of a sudden, a city like the size of York or Johnstown or Erie could be thinking about how they create vehicle-to-infrastructure connection, where a car can talk to a streetlight. And here, very soon, we'll have the ability for your car to talk to a streetlight to talk to your house. Why? because Duquesne Light is deploying 580,000 advanced metering infrastructures on every building throughout their footprint, which is a Wi-Fi node that will allow the utility to talk to the home and the home to talk to the utility. And your car will, or does, have the ability to send its own signals now, right? So you have things like V2I, vehicle to infrastructure, vehicle to grid communications that can happen. Your streetlights are no longer just about illumination, they're also about air quality monitoring. They're about identifying different pollutants that are in the air. They're also about identification of events and activating if an event were to occur, a major storm is coming. So at a local scale, a small municipality, when they get this idea and opportunity in their head, the deployment of it is very fundable, number one, and possible, number two. Local governments provide that opportunity. The other piece of that question is, like, how do you put together those right partners? You know, some place, like, does a Johnstown have a research university? No. But there's educational partners, whether it's on the technical capacity or in the workforce development side, that you could start to spin together as networks to solve these common challenges and solutions.
Yeah, first of all, let me just say that I've lived in Pittsburgh now 40-some years, and I'm really, really proud of the job that Mayor Peduto and people like you and people like Bob Gradek are doing, because, you know, it's the use of technology and it's the practical application of it. My comment is that there are so many people that don't even know that any of this stuff exists, okay? Like, I live in an area close by. My neighbors are very smart. And I mentioned this brown bag lunch to them, and I said it's an UXER kind of thing. And of 20-some people there, not one person knew what UXER was, okay? So you have great, Bob Gradek did a great job with the demographic database, but like nobody knows about it, nobody's gonna use it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is there a way that you guys can get the word out better, whether it's public service announcements on TV, or whether it's social media, I don't know what, but so many people are, you know, not going to be able to avail themselves of these wonderful resources because they don't know they're there.
Mm-hmm. First of all, thank you. And second, I think that is like one of the big challenges, right? Is the communications cluster, right? Like how do you start to bridge through all of the noise that's out there? And we have more choices now than ever. I think, one of the things that, from the city standpoint, that, and I too have lived here for a fair amount of time, is that we have gone through more civic engagement in the last 3 years than I can ever remember. There might be a way to measure that, but I mean, everything from deliberative democracy forums, and we got plans coming out the wazoo. And they were all provided by the input of residents. So that engagement is good. The thing that, like what you're getting to is a valid point, is the empowerment. Like, how do we take the information? This is like one of the fundamental challenges and the opportunities, that we will have massive amounts of data available, but how do we use it? How do we create those user interfaces that create the ability to, you know, fix a pothole in real time or something crazy like that? I don't want to make any promises, but like, you know, like there's these abilities now that we are all struggling with. You know, I mentioned our energy intelligence network. We are getting energy consumption data at intervals of 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes, we get a little blip of data. Now, the question, I think that, and this is, you know, part of maybe the research and the academic and kind of the partnership, is like, as a manager of these systems or a consumer of that information, what do we do with that? Like, what do I need 15-minute energy data for? I mean, it shows me trends, And within those trends, I'm able to determine that the county is heating and cooling our office space at the same time and blowing a lot of energy away. That is a commentary, by the way.
They've been doing that for years.
Now I can prove it. Now the question is, how do I change it? Right? And that happens, I think, that's also at us as a consumer or resident level is like, so now that we know this, what do we do with it? You know, and I think whether that's, you know, the gentleman sitting next to you, Alex, I mean, we're looking at a project with regards to a program called Transit Screen. You know, and for me, I mean, Alex probably has a bunch of great ideas with it, but for me, one of the fundamental issues is about choice. So if I know that a bus is coming at X time, does that change for me getting on that bus or taking a bike or calling a zip car or cab or whatever? Like, so it starts to allow us to hopefully make more intelligent decisions that start to advance like the changes that I made out. Yeah, you ma'am.
You seem to borrow quite a few of the terms actually from the field of ecology, which is not so surprising because ecology is also so much about seeing how systems interact, responsiveness to environmental changes, ability to adapt to changes. And you also pointed out that you do not want to just go for sexy technology things. I think you can see already a lot of positive examples here, like green infrastructure programs. But I'm also thinking about like people drowning on Washington Boulevard. I hope it's just a patchwork solution. We went for a technology thing with the barriers that then did not work. How do you make it possible that what technology we will implement that also will be robust enough to really answer all future problems? Or will it be, you know, if there's a really big rainstorm, everything breaks down again? How do you make the technology also robust? And wouldn't it be better then to revert to more natural systems?
Mm-hmm. So, I'm going to editorialize for a second. So you picked a really good example. And what I would say is that, actually that's an excellent example of kind of my point, is that going to a technology solution first, a gate, a lever, I mean it's not like high-tech whiz-bang stuff, but like that doesn't and didn't solve the problem, right? And one of the things that we did back in December as part of our 100 Resilient Cities partnership is we worked with an engineering firm who is called Arcadis. And part of the 100 Resilient Cities program is that we have afforded to us what's called a group of platform partners. These are companies that are have engaged with the network of cities on a quid pro quo relationship. That is that they see cities as a market, and they want to test the technology or practice, and we need kind of expertise and capacity to help advance issues. So we asked Arcadis, who had worked their Dutch company, and in Holland there is a philosophy that is every drop counts. Okay. And what they mean by every drop counts is that effectively is water is sacred. And when you live below sea level, that becomes a fundamental problem. You're really cognizant of that, right? So understanding how you live with water and how you manage water is deeply ingrained in their ethos. And typically they have done a process, what they call Dutch dialogues, which are design charrettes, looking at addressing kind of the landscape and architecture of how water flows and works. And we asked them to look at this problem in a different way. We have the pictures, we have the architecture and the engineering, What we needed, though, was advice on the economics, how do you finance a project, the policy, and how do you organize and structure yourself to solve the problem, in this case at the Nugley Run watershed. And they helped us facilitate this workshop that brought together kind of all the practitioners in that space. And what was interesting is none of the conversation focused on technology. It was geared around what are the priority areas in which you could start first and make a large impact, in this case the bottom portion of the watershed because it's in public ownership. How do you look at triggers, you know, kind of events or activities that allow you to initiate a certain policy or practice, like, for example, when is a development at the top of the watershed going to occur? How does that influence your design decisions so you can mitigate the risk at the bottom portion of the watershed? But then also, how do we pull together capital in order to invest in the watershed? So, for example, when you look across, actually not just the Nugley Run, but across the city, one of the biggest contributors of stormwater is roads. So we can put as many rain barrels out that we want or as many bioswales, and they're all fabulous, but when you think about how do you manage water, you have to think about where you have concrete, and roads are one of the key components of that. So when is PennDOT going to be making investments in that watershed fundamentally changes our thinking with regards to how do you manage that water. So how do you use that capital resources in a more strategic way? So in many cases, it's not about technology so much as how do you coordinate capital, create the right policies, and fundamentally organize yourself to solve the scale of the problem. Others?
Next question.
Come on, somebody give me something hard.
This is probably a softball question, but that's okay. Grant, so you made the marathon analogy earlier when talking about kind of sustainable cities and how it's a constant kind of endurance test. And so I was just kind of curious, what do you see as kind of the finish line for a sustainable city? I mean, is that the ability to be flexible to every event? Is it, and kind of how do you account for some of those black swan events too that, you know, we may not even be able to think about?
Sure.
Kind of where it's going.
So, all right, so this is where my analogy falls apart. So it is an endurance event from the standpoint that I think when you have to understand that, A, the distance, it maybe relay is maybe a better analogy, is that you have to, the marathon relay. So you run 26 miles and somebody runs another 26. So, like, you have to understand, I think, that the way to build this is that there is no finish line. This is really about systems of continuous improvement, right? Like you're going to continually find ways in which you're going to make progress and you're going to then adapt. You know, a good piece of our work, I think, and part of that is being flexible, and I'll get into your Black Swan event in a second, is that a lot of our work in the past 3 years has really been about measurement. And for the first time, like, establishing measurement protocols within city operations as they pertain to sustainability. So, you know, for example, that has a couple components to it. We report greenhouse gas emissions data to organizations like the Carbon Disclosure Project. We measure our own progress domestically against the American Council for Energy Efficient Economies, or ACEEE. We're proud to say in the last 2 years we've gone from 25 to 20, and hopefully we're going to crack the top 20 here this year. Tools like Green Workplace Challenge, Municipal Pennsylvania Sustainable Municipal Certification. These are all ways in which we look at ourselves of opportunities to improve. And that is kind of, you know, measuring our baseline as a city against ourselves, but also against other cities. So when we think about that, it requires time and endurance to make those changes. The other thing that I think that in Pittsburgh I've had to teach myself as being someone who's somewhat competitive is that our arc of history in sustainability is different than other cities, and that's true of every city. I belong to a network, which is like my personal therapy and support group, called Urban Sustainability Directors Network. So these are like me from other cities all around North America. When we first got there, there was a group that was called the Vanguard Group of Cities. And this was like Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, and, you know, like all those Pacific Northwest places who are blessed or cursed, depends how you want to talk about it, with tons of hydropower. And their history is of industrialists who pluck salmon out of the river and cut down trees and made money, where ours dug lumps of black rock out of the ground and burned it. Like, so there's a different kind of context with regard to how they relate to the environment. And I always remind them that all the washers and dryers and cars, somebody built and manufactured that steel from, you know, here. So we have to be cognizant of our starting place and, you know, kind of our history and context and with which we're operating. In terms of, like, how do you catalog it or deal with it in terms of an event, the resilience practice really takes us to start to think about events as opportunities. You know, there's the, and kind of the lesson learned is our colleagues in New Orleans. You know, Katrina was a horrible event in so many ways for that city. But when you talk to Jeff Hebert, who's my colleague in the Chief Resilience Officer in New Orleans, the arc that they have traveled in the last 10 years and their adoption of sustainability and resilience practices is fundamentally shifting how they operate and how they think, right? You know, they just recently created, and this is like advertising and plug to Sabina, like they have just created a sustainability and resilience commission, which is reviewing projects. And it is in that project review that they're looking at kind of the impact the project might have on wetlands or ecosystem restorations, or the impacting, you know, kind of flooding and development practices in around the city. So they have taught themselves to use events as opportunities. One of the things, just a final thought on that, is that, you know, as part of our implementation of our resilience strategy, you know, we're working on a project right now with a company called Intermedics and Don Burke, the dean over at the School of Public Health, on modeling contagion. So they're doing like crazy stuff in terms of like if influenza were to spread and what would happen and impact. We said, let's look at this from a stress context. What happens if we have a stretch of 2 weeks of 98 degree days, full industrial production from a petrochemical plant in Beaver County, and all of a sudden an inversion comes over western Pennsylvania and sits? Like, what happens to cardiopulmonary events? You know, so like thinking about those types of activities in advance and how we guide our response is part of the ethos that we need to start to adopt and engage in, so that not only are we able to respond in a smart way, but that we're able to, you know, use those events to ensure and secure systems.
Dave. Robot cars. How are we going to make sure that they are adding to our transportation goals and aren't winding up robbing riders from more efficient and more sustainable ways of getting around?
Sure. Man, that's a good question. That's what I want. Tough stuff. So, you know, one of the things that we're looking at, Dave's question is about robot cars and what do we do with them. There's a couple of things. I mean, one, just fundamentally, not so much fundamentally, but tactically, we're working within the planning department and with the American Architectural Foundation to pull together an event in May, which is kind of a deep policy think on this topic. And, you know, one, the part of the questions is, what are the policies that we need to engage in and change and model in the advancement, as the advancement of this technology comes to bear, right? That's one. The second big piece, I think, is really about urban design practices. And there's some really good research by the RAND Corporation folks here in Pittsburgh's RAND office did that looks at if you abandon good urban design practices, how automated vehicles could create the same type of detrimental effects that the interstate highway system did. And I think that's a key piece for us to think about in terms of both the application of autonomy and how it can be a net benefit and a net detractor. So policy, urban design. And then I think the other thing that we need to think about is really about finance. You know, us in particular, we have kind of a twisted web in Pittsburgh where municipal finance and parking facilities are inextricably linked. So our pension funds in the city of Pittsburgh are tied to parking receipts. What happens if nobody parks anymore? So thinking about the issue of stranded assets in terms of parking facilities is something that's, again, real critical from a finance standpoint, but also in terms, I think, of how do you make sure that those assets are no longer stranded assets, but you use them for another productive purpose. Predominantly, I think energy production is a huge opportunity that we have.
Oh. One more question or something.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the details of the proposal? Like, why would Columbus win, and what can you learn from them?
It's the perfect last question.
The perfect last question. So why did I'll give you the details, and then I'll tell you about Columbus, and then where can we go? So the details is that our proposal was a lot, and it dealt with everything from fundamental infrastructure changes revolving around street lighting and energy connection. So looking, I talked, you know, the gentleman about the impact that street lighting has. So street lights provide us a fundamental foundation from which to serve that confluence of energy, mobility, and the third piece, the ICT network. Okay, so where does the internet come from? So having the ability to have, quote unquote, a smart street light allows us to provide a platform not just for that public safety benefit of illumination, but also how do you relay data? How do you use that relay of data to engage the mobility and the energy system? The other piece was really around the idea of traffic signalization. So how do you, and this is something that we've already deployed and is working and doing a fairly good job, but how do you use traffic signalization or traffic signals that talk to one another in order to manage congestion? So one of the tools that we've used is a company called SureTrack, which started at Carnegie Mellon, that in the Baum Center corridor where we have them deployed currently, they talk to one another, allowing the flow of traffic to be managed. And what that does is it reduces idling time, improves air quality, and reduces emissions. One of the other key items is really this issue of what we call an electric avenue. An electric avenue is based on the idea of how we fuel, and you use fuel in quotes, or how do we power vehicles into the future. So what we had posited through the partnership with the Center for Energy here at Pitt is the creation of a solar-powered DC microgrid that charges our permits, licenses, and inspection vehicles. So we have 50 Ford foci that sit at the head of the Second Avenue parking lot, and we're still advancing this project. Actually, all three of the projects we're still advancing, but basically transitioning those vehicles to electric vehicles and then connecting them to a clean and renewable resource and using DC power to do it. So traditionally, AC power, which is all around us right now, requires conversion. Those little boxes on our plugs for our iPhones and devices and doodads. Using DC saves an exponential amount of energy in terms of not reducing or reducing the ability to have that transition. And then the other major components are really about thinking about the workforce. So like, how do you build, as I talked about earlier, the capacity in the workforce to build these technologies here and to maintain these technologies here. So fundamentally creating kind of a workforce of the future around smart city technologies. So why did Columbus win? There's a lot of theories on this. I won't get into the political ones. But one of the things that they were able to do, and I think, let me say the other innovation, was that I talked about the Smart PGH Consortium. And for us, that was found and is foundational, is that you have the governance structure in place in order to orchestrate and to work collectively on these issues. Columbus had already had a network of that same type of affinity, and they were able to bring dollars to the table. So making actual capital commitments and in leveraging the investment of the to a scale, which all the other cities did as well, and I think that's part of the debate, is really, did you have that money? So all the other six cities did the same thing, but they were able to put an amount of money on the table that I think the DOT felt was like the biggest ROI on their investment. That said, I think actually, don't tell the mayor this, but like actually not winning has been just as good for us. We've been able to leverage the Smart Cities proposal to encourage investment from PennDOT in traffic signal technology. We have some major grants in front of Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection on our Second Avenue project. And we're following through with the plan just at a different rate. Streetlights is a project that's going to happen here in 2017. So you're going to see a lot of this stuff literally hit the street. It's just going to be the acceleration is going to be a little bit different.
Well, good. We look forward to all that, Grant, and appreciate what a great talk and all of you with your questions and coming. So thank you again.
All right. Thanks, guys.